All right, good afternoon, everyone. It's Thursday, and we are doing a podcast in reaction to what happened in Sutherland Springs, Texas, this past Sunday morning. And I guess the word that I think that could describe what happened in Texas would be a nightmare. Sunday, I hadn't watched any news. I was in my office. I didn't turn CNN on. I was working on something else. Chris Sane comes up to me and says, did you hear about what happened in Texas? No, I have no idea what you're talking about. He begins to describe it to me. And quite frankly, it was emotionally overwhelming because you just think to yourself, what if that was Berean? What if that was your church? I mean, how do you have a funeral? How do you have 20 plus? Was it 25? Is that the correct number?
26.
26. I mean, it's just unbelievable. It is just beyond comprehension that a man would walk into your church with an automatic weapon or semi-automatic weapon or a weapon that can fire a lot of rounds very quickly and begin shooting people. Your thoughts, Steve, when you heard about it?
Just overwhelming. This thing just, you know, just kind of blows you away.
And the last time we heard about something like this was in South Carolina. It was the Bible study on Wednesday night. And the man in this case stayed with the church, is what I remember. They befriended him, and he stayed till the end of the Bible study, and which was even unbelievable there. And, of course, that one was motivated by race, as I recall. And in this case, we found out that it's been a what? Domestic violence incident?
Mm-hmm. But like yet the grandmother-in-law?
Something bizarre that, like
yeah,
that.
I haven't heard.
Yeah, right. But
I
yet,
just, I heard the one of the Texas, I don't know if it was the DA or general attorney, attorney general said, you know, that was their, you know, the largest mass casualty in Texas. And, I mean, you just think of that. And just that really took me for a loop, too. Thinking of that, you know, of all the, you know, of all the tragic things that have happened in the state of Texas in all the years, you know, that's their largest mass casualty.
Yeah, it's insane. So we have two articles for you. We have one from Joe Carter, Gospel Coalition website, in which he's going to give us seven ways to prepare your church against violence. And then what did you find, Joey? I mean, Nate?
Paul Chappell, about 2 days after what happened Sunday, he wrote an article named Five Biblical Responses to a Church Shooting.
Yeah. All right, so let's get started. November 8, 2007 is the date of my article.
A homeless man you've never seen before visits your church, stands in the back behind everyone who is sitting down, and begins eating a piece of chicken on a switchblade knife. How would your congregation respond? That's a situation a church plant in Virginia faced several years ago. When the elders approached the man, they discovered he knew someone in the church, and that person was able to help them ask the visitor to put away the weapon. Fortunately, the knife-wielding man had no intention of harming anyone, but that wasn't known, and couldn't have been known, until the church leaders confronted the stranger, putting their own lives in potential danger. Over the past few years, church shootings like the one this week in Texas have captured our attention. But mass shootings in the church are extremely rare events. The actual threats of violence your church is likely to face are more likely to be similar to the scenario in Virginia, a situation that is unexpected, unusual, and for which the appropriate response is unclear. So how can we prepare for the range of potential violence we may encounter on Sunday mornings? While there are excellent resources and organizations that can help you develop formal and specific plans, here are seven general actions to prepare your church.
All right, let's stop with that. So I was presented with one of these situations, because, you know, Joe's kind of giving us this wild stuff that you may deal with. And this one was during a worship service at a church in our city, two males began to express affection for one another right there in the congregation. So, you know, sometimes every now and then you'll see a guy reach over and give his wife a peck on the cheek or something like that. You know, I'm not a big fan of that. I feel like we come here to worship, not to do a little tongue-in-cheek action with your wife. But this is two guys. Now just imagine over in your section where you're sitting in power hour or whatever the case may be, or John, you look down from the, and as you're leading singing, and you see two males, you know, doing a little hugging, a little kissing, touching on the bottom, kissing each other right there in your worship service. So this person saw it and was bothered by it and went to talk to the senior pastor about it and finally got an appointment with him. And he let her know that in their church, they love everyone. Everyone is loved and, you know, we're not here to condemn and we're not here to judge. But it made me think about what would we do, you know? How do you walk up to somebody and confront them? And there's the growing world that we're living in, there's a greater need to confront people. Just think about churches in the past have been known to pass out blankets or towels or things to help people be more modest because you have this ownership of the sanctuary and this need to protect what happens inside it. Or what about someone's prophesying? Middle of your worship service, John, break, when you take a breather, and someone says, "Thus saith the Lord," and they stand up and they start prophesying.
You remember the tambourine lady?
Yes.
I just wish she would have stayed on beat, that's all.
Yeah, I remember.
It was kind of weird, though.
Yeah.
And then the church I attended in Chattanooga, it was a lady with a little dog in a purse, used to just take laps around the auditorium, and they had a corraler. You know, just not all there.
But you have to deal with stuff. I mean, you have to deal with stuff in the auditorium. So let's see what he has to say.
Number one, communicate to your congregation as much as possible and consistent with the leadership and decision-making structure of your church. You should solicit the input of your congregation before making a formal security plan. This is especially necessary for pastors and leaders who may be serving in cultures or regions whose perspective may differ from their own. For example, elders carrying concealed pistols during church services may be culturally accepted in rural Texas, but may cause a scandal in a suburban California congregation. Once the church agrees on what security measures are acceptable, that information needs to be regularly disseminated, at least annually, to the entire congregation. Simply being aware that the church has a plan of action can help alleviate the worry and concerns of members.
All right, so how do you do that, Steve? I mean, if he writes a sentence, that's wonderful, but
can you imagine? We're going to have a meeting and discuss whether we should conceal and carry or not. It would just be all over the map.
I mean, what are your thoughts when he says that? Because we talked earlier in the week. How do we communicate to the congregation? You were talking about the necessity of getting the congregation to understand that really you thought the best thing to do is stop where you're at and get underneath the pews. Get to as low to the ground as possible. Right. And just wait for someone to communicate that it's safe.
Correct.
Yeah.
Because normally, you know, if everybody starts running around, it causes more havoc, more issues, and you have more of a chance of getting hit by a bullet. And then if you do have security or if you do have people that have concealed carry, you're just going to get in their way. And it makes it even more dangerous for them trying to take the active shooter out because then you're in the way and, you know, you're blocking their shot.
Can you believe we're having this conversation?
No. Yes.
You say yes. Yeah. You say no.
I say no. I mean, yes, in the world we live in, but it's just sad that you can't even go to, you can't go to church without being concerned that you're going to get shot.
But I think his point is better received if we had a basic understanding to springboard from. What I would say probably to this group and to anybody listening is I would love to know the number of churches that have a safety plan that is articulate, spelled out, public knowledge for a storm, hurricane, tornado, fire. What's the escape routes? Where are they posted? Do the people in the congregation understand that if a fire broke out in our church building, what is our proper egress to ensure that we don't have a stampede to the nurseries, we don't have a stampede to this point? Where are the collection points for our children? Where are our safety zones?
Right, but how do you communicate that? That's what I want.
What has to happen is that has to be publicly on your website. It has to be on your constant slides that are rotating in your hallways. is, have you checked out our safety plan? Have you checked out this? Have you checked out that? When you have first class, it's given as a part of the informational packet to potential members. And I think then at this point you can say, okay, now we're going to escalate this and add in our active shooter component.
And I think one of the more difficult parts about church in particular, as opposed maybe to some other things that occur in life, is the rehearsal aspect. Because yep. we all know that we've all sat down and made a really awesome document. And we even sent it out to people. Mm-hmm. But we have no idea how much they're getting until you actually go through it. Say it's a document, say, Pastor Sean, it's a document about how you're going to carry on a ceremony. You know, you've probably done this. Someone's planned the event and all this. But then you get to that first rehearsal, and it's chewed up. And you have to go over and over and over until people, no, you stand here. Why do you keep going over here? No, you're over here. Well, we don't do anything like that. We hardly do that in our worship music. I mean, we because of time of people. And so doing something like a plan where, like in school, you can say, okay,
what'd you do at church today? Well, we did a fire drill.
Yeah.
You know?
So. But to have your Sunday school teachers come in for training. And if you're going to be a Sunday school teacher, you have to understand you're going to come to quarterly rehearsals of our safety plan so that they have it, so that those who are placing their children and their care into those workers' hands have an understanding. These people are trained in the case of an emergency, all varieties. They know what to do. Trust us. Go pick up your child at location X.
Mm-hmm. And I think in probably the best in our day and age kind of halfway point between full-out, you know, rehearsals of that would be videos where someone, you know, rehearses for them in a video and points out the egress and does that after the plan's on paper, clearly known, actors portray this, and someone can go on the website, watch a video, okay, here's where you come to in the nursery, or here's where we're going if a fire breaks out or a tornado or whatever, and have some actors do that. The video's on the website, and then you point people to the video because it's almost like walking through it.
Plus, you would be able to see what you're actually going to see.
Right.
In the
yeah, you could take a point of view camera down the hallway as you leave the building. You know, and it would take maybe 30 seconds.
Kind of like what I did a few weeks ago
with the parking lot.
The parking lot traffic.
Yeah, that was excellent.
Yep. Yep. So, you know, there's probably some ways that we could look at doing that more.
Number two, be realistic about your security context. Threats to churches vary in kind, degree, and probability. Your church needs to be honest about the most likely threats of violence you may face in your particular context and the most appropriate actions to protect against them. Some threats, such as mass shootings, are a low probability event for all congregations. Others will be based on the location of the church. For instance, a medium-sized church located in a high-crime area of a city will face different challenges than a small church in a low-crime rural setting. Hiring an off-duty police officer to patrol the lobby during the morning service may be a prudent measure for the former, while being costly and unnecessary for the latter. While the rural church shouldn't overreact by implementing expensive security measures, the city church should not ignore the real dangers they may encounter.
All right, any thoughts?
It's a good point. I just can't help but think about the church I grew up in that has I'll call it a security team, that is really just a couple guys hanging out in the lobby during church services, but you have three guys in the lobby at any given time for a church service on a Sunday night of 30 people. Like, not being realistic about, like, okay, you know, I love the people dearly, but, like, you're 75 years old and you're not carrying a gun. Like, what are you going to do to protect us right now?
Yeah, and there's ditches on both sides of the street because you have that scenario. And certainly in my college, you know, one of my colleges, the security team was, like, the butt of a lot of jokes because they constantly crashed their little car into stuff and bent it up, and they were like Barney Fife. Then on the other side, you come to a church like this, and we got some seriously trained dudes in our church who can do some, you know, really serious damage on a bad guy and know the situations, have been trained by the military.
But they're not our security team.
But you know, there's probably a ditch on that side, too. You know, if you got too many guys running around shooting at things,
Well, the problem is there's huge liability for them because they're not
sworn officers.
And
right, but what I'm saying is several of them kind of get this hoo-ah attitude, you know, and they you know, survivalists, and, you know, I've got a couple in my family. And, you know, well, if anything's wrong, I'm taking them out. You know, that kind of attitude. Well, that might not be helpful either when you're trying to develop a reasonable security plan.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting considering the context of the article with everything that happened in Texas. I don't know if you guys have seen it, you know, but I read an article about the gentleman that actually, they're claiming is the hero that stopped it. I don't know to what degree he actually did, but he confronted the shooter, hid behind a pickup truck, and was exchanging gunfire with the shooter, and ended up chasing. He hit him twice while he was wearing a bulletproof vest, ended up jumping in a truck that was just driving by, and then chased down the shooter. And by the time they got to him, he had already shot himself to completely, you know, take his life, even though he was bleeding out. And the media, this is Yahoo News that this article is on, they're hailing him as a hero. And I almost wondered to what degree is this guy a hero because he isn't the one that had the kill shot. He hit him twice, probably would have led to this guy's death, but he was fleeing the scene, and he went and chased after him. If he had, if this good Samaritan that did that had been the one that had, you know, issued the kill shot, would he still? Would there be someone out there that's trying to spin it, and where that guy would be accountable for it?
Well, that's what Steve's saying with
the and I know, but it's kind of the just thinking about the situation where that America's dealing with because of the gravity and the realistic nature of this is, you know.
Well, and I would say more than likely there is someone out there that would try to prosecute the guy because he, you know, they would have said, well, you chased him down, you this, and, you know, at, you know, and our laws, as crazy as they might be, you know, if somebody breaks in your house, yeah, sure, you can shoot him, but as soon as they turn around to run away, the threat is no longer existent, and if you shoot him, then you're going to go to jail because you shot him in the back and they weren't a threat.
Well, certainly at that point you become judge and jury. I mean, if someone's fleeing a scene, they've done, I mean, obviously we know the guy shot the folks, but as he's leaving, now you've made the decision he's going to die.
Right, and that's what I'm saying is, you know, at that point, now our court system is going to say you crossed the line, and now you're going to pay.
But our court system would still support you if you shot them in the back while they're staying in the middle of your living room.
You would have to prove that you were still being threatened.
Or eminent domain, castle domain law.
If they're inside your house,
if they're inside your living room, once they turn to go out the exit of your home,
right.
That's where that kicks in. Yeah. You would be held liable,
right?
And in this case, had Brian, he killed the guy
inside the church,
or while being fired upon outside. He's coming by. This guy's coming out of the church. He fires on this new guy because, hey, what's going on over there? Boom, he starts firing. This guy draws, fires back. He takes that guy down. Chances are, except for a few states in our nation of most liberal nature, he'll be fine.
But that's different. But the guy's in the truck, taking off, and as soon as he started pursuing and chasing
him, if he'd have taken another shot,
because
that
he'd become a vigilante at that point.
Right. Yes. Yes. So, in any situation, the context of security is defined by the fluidity of the moment. And the moment, and the purpose of self-defense laws is to not so much take the life of another person, but to provide you the opportunity for escape or to deter them to the point that they extract themselves and your life is no longer threatened.
Right. And the safest thing from number two that I pull out is, you know, the safest thing is you hire a police officer to be on your campus.
Yep.
At, you know, $60 for 2 hours or because they can even pursue. Oh, yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, if you have an officer at that point, he can deputize anybody he wants to. You know, if, you know, he can have somebody else shoot, and it's all legal at that point.
Number three.
It's just costly. It costs money.
As think outside the church door. While the main priority of church leaders must be to focus on the safety of the congregation while in the church building, we should consider how we could protect members outside the church doors. As Duke Kwan, pastor of a church in Washington, D.C., recently noted on Twitter, here in D.C., our members have a much higher chance of getting shot while walking to church than while worshiping. To reduce such risk, we can implement programs that protect people as they come to and from the church, such as having pickup and drop-off van service or providing volunteers to walk them home. Larger churches may also need to have patrols of the parking lots to ensure the safety of all churchgoers as they enter and leave church services.
Okay, Duke Kwan, respect your idea and love your intention of having somebody walk somebody home, but in Washington, D.C., that is not going to be protection against a criminal shooter, because in Washington, D.C., if you're a legal gun owner, you're not allowed to have it out in D.C., outside of your apartment. So if you're walking them home and you have your gun on you and somebody comes up to shoot you and you draw and you shoot, you're still guilty because you violated gun law.
In the District of Columbia.
In the District of Columbia, inside the Beltway. Yeah. Yep. So great intent, but we're talking about somebody that's stopping a physical violence of maybe hand-to-hand violence.
Or New York State.
Now, driving them? Great idea.
Yeah, well, it almost seems like that's Joe's comments rather than Kwan.
Because he's not saying they have a gun on them.
Yeah, walking them home puts two people at risk versus one.
Right.
I mean, I hate to say that, but...
Yeah, especially because of the shooting.
But then you almost wonder, like, what's he talking about? Is he talking about, you know, single moms that might be subject to sexual harassment, you know?
He says they have a higher chance of getting shot while walking to church than worshiping.
Yeah,
so somewhere in the context of being shot at.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, well, I think the second half of the statement is actually our author, whereas the quotation ends.
Right, and our author is saying, we'll walk somebody home. Well, in that case, you're going to be...
Yeah, well, and it's kind of a...
But the intent is well.
Secondary thought is, I think, isn't Joe Carter our author from the Gospel Coalition that we just disagreed with some things the other week?
Yes, yes.
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, right. He is. All right, number four.
Understand the singular threat of domestic violence. The one threat every church should expect and prepare for is spillover of domestic violence into the church. Over the past 50 years, the targeting of a family member or intimate partners has been the motive in almost 20% of church shootings. And while statistics are not kept on the prevalence of such acts, violence that starts in the home is likely to be one of the most prevalent types of violent attacks encountered in church buildings. Church leaders should be aware of which members of the congregation are vulnerable to violence in the home. Not only should we be helping to find a solution to the problem in the home, we also need to prepare for how we can protect such members when they are at church. In taking such precautions, we must be careful to respect the privacy of the abused. We don't want to draw unnecessary attention to their plight, but we also should make it clear to them that they should be able to feel safe and free from threat when they are on church grounds.
I remember the first time I saw this, I was on vacation down in my wife's hometown, and so we went to this big church. It was kind of had a new building and all, so we went and they were still building the new building, so they were in this gymatorium type deal, and they had like a boom camera that like came down and the guy wrote it, and I was like, this is kind of weird church, right? Well, it got even weirder because these two dudes up in front of me, big old guys, started fist fighting over this other girl right in the middle of the song service.
Wow.
And then here comes security, you know, dragging them out. I was like,
they steal
their
cue?
Well, you don't see that every day.
Wow.
I mean, just going, bam, bam.
Expressing the gift of the Spirit.
Yes. Holy pound.
All right, let's find out what five is.
Identify and prepare the guardians. Every church should identify and prepare members who are expressly willing to rescue the weak and the needy and deliver them from the hand of the wicked. Psalm 82, verse 4. These should be volunteers willing and able to lay down their lives to protect their brothers and sisters in Christ. John 15:13. Once identified, they need to understand how they will be expected to prepare and respond when threats of violence arise. Their regular duties may be as simple as having them regularly sit in pews close to the door during church services, or to be the one to dial 911 in an emergency. Whatever their roles, they should each also be aware that they might be called upon to sacrifice themselves in order to buy a few minutes for others to get to safety. These guardians don't need to be the police officer or former SEAL team veteran. They don't need to be the biggest and bravest in the congregation. All they need is the conviction that they will do whatever is in their power to protect the church from violence.
It's
going to
be the greatest
marksman. Yeah. Number 6. Protect the children. The self-identified guardians have the responsibility to protect the congregation. But the congregation should be aware that their primary security responsibility should be to protect the children. Every safety measure taken should be measured against this standard. Every security policy should start with this goal. In every step you take to protect your church from violence, the primary concern must be to protect the children. And I think, just thinking about my experience with churches, I mean, with ours here, in the last year, 2 years, we've taken a lot of steps without having any, you know, violence arise to understand that our children's ministry and nursery facilities needed greater security. But I don't think a lot of churches take that one to heart to even, I mean, regardless of whether you have church shootings or not, just keeping the children's and where they are safe should be a very high priority for churches.
So what time do those doors lock, Steve, on Sunday mornings?
Currently?
Yeah.
The inside doors or the exterior?
The inside doors.
15 minutes after each service or Sunday school or service begins.
Right. Okay. And then what about how are we managing all the, I mean, what do we have, 20 doors? We have a lot, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, 4 on that side, 4 in the back, 4 in the front. That's 12, and I haven't even got to the other doors.
Oh, we have a lot. We have a lot of doors.
Yeah.
The,
6, I mean, well, if you count this, you got 6 in the narthex, 4 in the back, that's 10, and then the 4 in the atrium.
14?
That are
open?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think
when do we close them?
They're open the whole time. I just talked to the deacon Sunday night about, you know, having security lock everything, or, you know, we'd have to come up with signage that says, you know, if you arrive after such and such a time, you must enter through the atrium. Mm-hmm. And then have one of the security guys would just be posted in the atrium, so right. If there is a latecomer, you know, then he's there to let them in.
Yeah, and you stop and you think about it, and if you're talking about doing an adequate coverage of this type of scenario, okay, well, we got the golf cart and we got the roving patrol, but is it enough people?
No.
For the exterior of our campus, you know, you got a layer that's the parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have all these doors. Then we have the internal doors where the children are protected behind magnetic sealed doors. You know, and that's a wonderful final defense layer,
barrier
type of thing, but there's so much before that. And I would probably challenge that ours isn't even adequate at its first layer in the parking lot, because if you only have 2 or 3 guys out there and they're working in tandem together, then you're going to have how many minutes before they come back around area A that I've decided is the best point of entrance for maximum damage.
Sure, yeah. I mean, ideally you need cameras and you need somebody watching a monitor set so that they could communicate to somebody.
And you'd almost need to have one stationary guy kind of per zone.
Again.
Or something to that effect. And there you're talking a massive
amount of people. But it ain't cheap at all, man. It's costly, costly, costly.
Cameras.
Cameras, yeah. Monitors, yeah. A station, all that.
Number 7. Prepare against anxiety and hard-heartedness. We live in a fallen world where violence can erupt at a moment's notice. We are not immune to such threats, even when we gather to worship our Creator. Because of this reality, churches must be prepared. We also live in a world under God's providential control. We must be cautious, but not fearful. We can shut our doors to those who need to hear the We can't shut our doors to those who need to hear the gospel because of our anxiety about violence. As Paul tells us, do not be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. Philippians 4:6-7. We should prepare our congregations to be ready for whatever threats of violence we may face. Yet, we must also be ready to sacrifice everything, including our security and our lives, for the sake of the gospel. We can make our churches hard targets, but we must do so with soft hearts.
Yeah. It's easy to write about it. I think it's super hard to implement it.
Yep.
I think it's really hard to implement it.
That's like saying sin is the problem. Well, we know that. We know it's the heart of the wicked man that did this. That's the root problem. But the question, well, what do you do about it? There's so many unconverted people, sinners in the world. We recognize that, but at times you feel powerless. And we can all get on the platitudes, well, prayer and God bring our nation back and all that. But the reality is, okay, well, let's talk about plan B, like if it never happens. What if we just continue on the glide path we're on?
Like the Bible says?
Yeah. Yeah. Then what? You know, or let's even change our scenario a little bit. What if we're in China? Mm-hmm. You know, what if we're in, you know, another part of the world where this is a regular daily threat thing, you know?
First century Christianity.
Yeah, so, you know, it's easy to say, have these answers, and you see the memes and you see the responses. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're responsible for here. And we want to be as wise as we can. And, like, you know, it's almost like you say it's costly and you got to spend the money, be loaded for bear, and never see anything but a rabbit. I don't know. I don't know where that line is. I mean, I'm glad it's your job to really kind of oversee and be the steward of that part of the ministry, because, you know, I wouldn't want to make that decision. Because certainly you don't want to spend a whole bunch of money and waste God's money, but at the same time, the moment that you realize you had a breach or a gap, you're going to beat yourself up over not covering that gap.
And, you know, you hear people in our congregation, because, again, you brought out all the military-connected pieces. We hear people all the time say, you know, if somebody walked into our church, the likelihood that we have quite a few number of members ready to defend, you know, is high. So they wouldn't get very far. And my thought is, you're right, they probably would not get very far. But then I shudder at, but who would be lost during the time that they got as far as they got?
Oh, and another part of that piece is, what if somebody in our own congregation was struggling like this guy was in the Air Force, you know, abusing his wife and having the conviction and all of that, and hit it? Because people do that. They have a duplicit life all the time.
Sure.
Yep.
So one of these guys that we think is a great guy, concealing, going to protect us, could end up being the one that does the damage.
All right, what'd you find for us?
Pastor Paul, Chapel hit 5 responses to this church shooting, how I guess a church or Christian should respond. And, you know, his first one was prayer. And, you know, I think about Sunday night and how you kind of led the church into a moment of silence and just remembering those, the church family, the families, the people who were plugged into those 26 people that lost their lives, you know, how hard it would be for them. So Paul reminds us of that same thing, praying even outside of the 26 who lost their lives and the people plugged into their lives is the 20 people who were injured. You know, and to think of possibly the, you know, years or months of recovery for, you know, how drastic the injury was from the bullet. And then secondly, he hit reject fear, and he kind of brings us to what kind of Jonathan was talking about earlier, is the fact that, you know, think about China. Think about what they're facing. The government doesn't even approve of their Christianity. And then he also brings the point up that think about the congregations that Paul and Peter were addressing, or John, you know, where they're dealing with people who are losing their lives for the cause of Christ, and it's just a normal thing. And then he said, just continue to preach the word and be careful not to make it a political platform, you know, to be sensitive to the loss of life, and you don't make this political statement or political platform because of that, and just keep doing as what a shepherd should be doing for his congregation and preaching the word. And then he hits basically what this first article hit on was physically protect your flock. Make sure you have a security plan, and depending on the church that you have, whether it's 50 people to 2,000 people, like, you need to have some type of plan and communicate it to your church as best you can. And then he says, you know, the last point that he made was remember your blessings, because mm-hmm. this very thing could happen to your church. And no matter how prepared you are, there might be loss of life, whether that's a couple or more.
Can anyone think of something better to do than to kind of hold in place until the situation settles down and you get evacuation direction from either security or law enforcement? I mean, could you imagine anything better in your mind, Steve or Jack, as to what to do when that first shot gets heard in the church? Because I mean, you just think about panic erupting with movement in various directions.
Right. And you know, often there's more injuries in the scurry and havoc following than just, you know, dive, you know, hitting the floor and really, you know, you play dead.
I think in our auditorium, that is the best case scenario, is that you go to ground. I mean, we did it in the military, right? First sure. shot's fired. What do we do?
We go
to ground, and then we find cover.
And
concealment.
Well, when you think about walking into our auditorium, if you could get as low to the ground and underneath the pew, you're going to have layers of protection. Because if the guy's in the back and you're mm-hmm. anywhere yes. in the middle, it's got to go through several yes. things before it ever gets to you.
And that would be the thing is from the. And you would almost want to get everybody to pack as close as they can to the front to move away from the door zone. What I was thinking about when we came across this guardian section and identifying guardians, where I sit is a perfect guardian seat in the 830 service. Mm-hmm. I'm right up against a pillar. There's nobody that's going to sit behind me. I sit there on purpose because I have paranoia to some degree. I don't like people sitting behind
me. I thought it was so that you could sleep, and it was harder for me to figure out if you were staying awake or not.
That's not it at all.
That's what I thought it was.
I'm not comfortable. Even in restaurants, I don't like people sitting behind me. I don't like that. I like to be against walls. So I'm against a wall.
Neurosis.
I can see, and here's what I know. I know that the doors to this side of me, on the right-hand side of me, are locked. All the way through. That door's never unlocked, so you're not going to come in that zone. If you are going to come in, you're going to come in from the pastoral hallway. I can see that door. I can see the door all the way across that comes in from the baptistry zone. Mm-hmm. I can see every door that comes from the coffee shop hallway, and I can see every main door that comes in.
Yeah, we just need to put like a machine gun nest right there, Jack, with you, and then a tripod, and you just take them out right
all
there,
I
man.
But, I hope it's but, not during worship, because I'm toast. I'm like the main target.
Right, because you're right up your frontal zone, right up
maybe,
front.
Maybe I should get a little more charismatic.
Aren't you glad you're not my height, Jonathan?
And
run around.
Yeah, I try to take pictures of you the other day, brother. You're safe. Just stay behind the pulpit. You're not getting a good line of sight on Jonathan.
Well, I know Matt Schubert and Raina and myself, with the meetings that we've had with our adults or volunteers that deal with the children, is that you try to pack as tight as you can and you get away from any line of sight, whether that's a door or window.
And we do have...
Right, if you're a person that's But what I'm saying is people strategically seated that if we went to this scenario where we said, okay, we don't want to pay the cops and we have people willing to assume risk.
And we do. Matt has one person in the auditorium every service that is that
ready to assume yes. risk. I know.
Yes.
And if you're in the 830, or no, it's actually 1045 now, we do have a police officer, a local law enforcement officer that would be able to also assist in that. But the line of sight for those guys needs to be present for the capability of like I said, if everybody went to ground,
right,
then they'd have clean line right. of sight to get to those right. areas.
And that's, you know, that's my thought, and, too, and, is I know we have enough people
and,
in our church.
And our head of security's guy who comes in, if it's any one of the two or three that I'm thinking of, they're usually over in my area, close to my area, and I would say it's probably for that reason.
Mm-hmm. All right, what about the doors to the back, Steve, of the Power Hour? Are those doors open? What are those doors, Nate?
For the chapel?
For the chapel.
They are closed, but they are not locked.
Mm-mm. Okay, I think that's a mistake.
Are they lockable?
Do they have a push bar on it?
Yeah, it'd be manually, though. It wouldn't be like the magnetic ones that we have in the new building.
But you don't dismiss it. They come in. You use the side door for everything, right?
No, they come in the back. They check in at the back because the influx of children.
Yeah.
So they enter the back, but theoretically within 5-10 minutes of dismissal from the auditorium, the those doors could be manually locked.
You don't like that idea?
No, I don't know if we should discuss our weaknesses on the mic.
Yeah. I think what I'm trying to do is help a few people think through like what they're doing in their own church
yeah.
or whatever. But, I mean, that's an easy...
Call names or anything.
That's an easy fix,
we don't
fix,
have
right?
any guardians in there.
But that's an easy fix.
Yes, we
do. Yes. Yes.
There are 35 armed guards.
We have kids packing.
Candy into their pockets.
All right, well, you have things to think about in your church. We have things to think about in our church. And, of course, we want to pray and continue to pray for those in Sutherland Springs. I was watching a CNN special the other day, and one of the families had 3 generations impacted.
Yeah.
3 generations.
8 people from the same family, something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
Well, all I could think about was the mother who was pregnant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really tragic. So we love you, brothers and sisters in Christ at First Baptist in Sutherland Springs. We pray for you this Sunday. I can't imagine coming back together for worship the following Sunday. That has to be. This Sunday's got to be a really hard day. I pray that the Spirit of God shows up in a marvelous way. And I pray that there are visitors beyond belief. And we know that there's going to be media there. And we know that there's media that are hearing the gospel all over again and again. They'll not be able to say, I had no idea that Jesus was thought to be a Savior by people, because they're going to hear it and hear it and hear it. So we pray that God would be glorified in this tragedy. And we thank you for listening. Have a good day.